The curiosity with which Europeans approached the New World was reflected in the writings of Italian historians, missionaries, travelers, and explorers who described with fascination the customs of the peoples they encountered in their travels. How did Italians in the Age of Enlightenment view America and Americans? As a land of opportunity and noble savages, or something else? And how did they come to those visions of America? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Stefania Buccini, professor of Italian at the UW-Madison and the author of The Americans in Italian Literature and Culture, 1700 to 1825. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
Before we get into the Enlightenment in Italy, how did it get preceded? We think of the Enlightenment as pretty much the whole 18th century. Was that the case in Italy?
Absolutely not. And this is an error of perspective which I continue to find in scholarly works. Each country has its own periodization, and Italy has its own. Essentially, the Enlightenment in Italy doesn't begin until the early 50s, around 1750, 1755. So what happens before? There is an Italian 18th century before the Enlightenment, and there are significant works at that time, significant relations with Europe, with other cultures. I have studied this particular period in relation to the Americas. How did early 18th century Italian perceive the New World? What I found out is that at the beginning of the century, through the 1750s, the Hispanocentric perspective prevails.
What kind of perspective?
Hispanocentric.
Okay. So they were influenced by Spain.
Absolutely. We also need to remember that Italy does not have a colonial possessions in the New World. Essentially, Italy looks at America, which the America that today we would call Latin America. There is very little interest in the British possessions in North America. This Spanish perspective prevails until, I would say, about the early 60s of the 18th century. And there is one particular work that helped with the shift of perspective, and it's the translation of the history of the British settlements in North America by Edmund and Edward Burke. This work was published in the translation of this work was published in Venice in 1763, and a good portion of the book is devoted to the noble savage, essentially, to the good qualities of the noble savage. Part of the book is devoted to the British possessions of North America. This is the time when Italians start looking at that part of the world, at that part of the continent. Until then, we have not only, Hispanocentric perspective, but also a Christian perspective. Essentially, these two lenses through which Italians were looking at the Americas merge.
So the Spanish, and the Christian. Does it make any difference? Is it specifically a Roman Catholic perspective, this Christianity?
Definitely Roman Catholic perspective, considering all the missionaries that traveled to the New World. And there is a very important work which appeared in Italy in 1743. I can give you the original in Italian. Il cristianesimo felice nelle missioni dei padri gesuiti del Paraguay. Happy Christianity in the missions of Paraguay, of the Jesuits in Paraguay. And what this Jesuits did, essentially, they were trying to rebuild an early Christian community in South America, in Paraguay.
An early, in the sense of some kind of purified, simplified form of Christianity?
Purified, simplified Christianity. There was no private property. The Indians were living in the so-called reduzioni, so in community. Yes.
Yes. Ownership not being a large part, certainly if you're talking about land ownership, not a large part of the Native American way of thinking.
Yes. Yes. And of course, the Roman Catholic Church wasn't particularly pleased with this project.
because they lacked the sort of controls that the Roman Catholic Church had developed over the centuries.
Yes, but he was also questioning some of the principles, some of the dogmas. So despite the concerns of the church, the work was published. And it's one of the most, I would say, provocative works that I found in the first part of the 18th century in Italy about the Americas.
Before we go too much further, I'm wondering, when we talk about Italy, it was not the country, the national borders that we're familiar with today, wasn't it? A fairly large number of smaller states?
Absolutely. Italy was divided in many states at that time. We need to wait until 1861 before we can see a unified country. Italy was essentially, has always been, you know, compared to the costume of Arlecchino. Many states like that.
And that would account for, I would guess, why Italy wasn't a colonizer, as France and Spain and other countries were.
Yes, but again, we had southern Italy was under the Spanish domination for many, many years. And there was a way to learn about the New World through Spanish works.
And where do we start seeing these ideas seep into Italian ways of thinking, into the literature, these ideas of, we'll call it the noble savage. That was the term that came out of the 18th century, this idealization of the Native Americans and their way of life. Where do we start seeing that coming into the literature?
I think we start seeing it pretty early. It's a figure that emerges also from the accounts of Jesuits, Franciscans, for instance. However, the noble savage is also, in a way, rediscovered by the Enlightenment. Despite being a time in history led by the idea of progress, by the strong confidence in reason, there are quite a few intellectuals who consider the noble savage an alternative to, I would say, the so-called civilization or modern civilization. I have found quite a few interesting passages in literature that refer to this.
Is this in a wistful way or in some kind of prescriptive way, we should be more like this, or just saying, oh, they really still have this notion of innocence and a kind of almost a paradise?
It's interesting because, again, the periodization is very important to answer your question. The Italian Enlightenment is a short but intense season. It doesn't last more than 30, 35 years. And towards the end of the Enlightenment, I'm speaking about the 1780s, we can see a resurgence of the myth of the noble savage. With the lack of confidence in Enlightenment ideas, the sense of progress, faith in the human mind, we can see that there is a rediscovery of the nobility of primitive men, of primitivism. And I have found this in quite a few works. But there is another important aspect to consider. Italian intellectuals during the Enlightenment and also towards the end of the Enlightenment seem to privilege, for instance, South American cultures.
South American cultures in specific?
Yes. In specific, Peru, for instance, the Incas.
As being a high degree of civilization and yet a high degree of freedom or simplicity at the same time? Why Peru? Why the Incas?
A combination. High civilization and primitivism and the ability to reconcile with nature. So I found this specific aspect in one author, but in others too, is Gian Rinaldo Carli. He was an economist, essentially. It's not uncommon for the 18th century to have these kind of Renaissance figures of men of letters who can be mathematicians and men of letters at
yes.
the same time. And Gian Rinaldo Carli was one of those who wrote the so-called, I mean, the title is Lettere Americane, American Letters. And Americane refers to Peruvians, to the Incas, essentially. And he's an economist. He's also very busy. He has also a government position. And he starts this work by saying, you know, I am writing these letters to you, cousin, to a cousin, because at night I really want to talk and talk to ancient Peruvians. I want to be in my study, sit at my desk and dream about Peru. And this is an amazing work.
And it's in the form of letters then?
In the form of letters to his cousin.
What was the reaction to this series of letters? Is he actually writing from Peru?
No.
He's imagining?
Study, in his, he was imagining that in his study he was sitting at the desk. That's what he said. And so I can forget about politics, economic issues, and I can dream about ancient Peruvians. And this is the time when the myth of Peru really reaches its peak. Really, he thinks Peruvians are essentially the most weird, because they don't exist anymore. The Incas were completely destroyed. Were the most, one of the highest cultures in the world, according to him.
Where is he getting his information?
He gets information because I'm sure lots of Spanish works were reaching Italy at this time.
About 200 years worth by then.
Yes, yes, definitely quite a few. Garcilaso de la Vega. Commentari Reali, definitely that is one of the works. And the bibliography is really, really significant. And the work was so popular that it was translated in many languages, also in English.
So this is the 1780s?
The first edition was published in 1780.
And it becomes very popular among the readership in Italy. What sort of literary or what sort of literacy rate do we see in Italy? Is there a big market for these books, by the sound of it?
These are books that circulate among scholars. Yes, only among scholars.
Does this series of imaginary letters then spark considerable conversation among these influential scholars, debate, people taking issue with it, or is it just kind of this wave of enthusiasm for the early Peruvians, for the Incas?
Before Carli, there were also other authors who focused on Peru, and there is in these works also a sense of regret for what Europeans did. This is something that I found fascinating. There is another author, Francesco Algarotti, who also wrote Saggio sopra l'Imperio degli Incas, essay on the Inca Empire. And again, we see this sort of regret. How could Europeans possibly destroy such a wonderful, wonderful culture?
how does that play out then in the course of the this what is it really a 30-year Enlightenment in Italy?
During the Enlightenment. There are definitely other works also that focus on this. The counterpart, in a way, is, of course, the noble savage, but the Incas had retained part of the noble savage.
They were so highly sophisticated in terms of their cities and their organization and their culture. I would guess another part of the noble savage myth, if you want to call it that, would be the more even simpler concept of, living in the forests and living off of the land. Do we see that we do see it?
In the Incas, not so much, also because very little was left in a way. But there were still like American nations that were living closer to nature. It's very easy to idealize a culture when this culture essentially has left wonderful things, wonderful relics, but it's not there.
So you can't see it in all its complexity, and perhaps you deduce from what you can see what you want to see.
Yes. There is another work that comes out at almost 4 years after Carli's letters. In 1784, Pietro Chiari, who was essentially also a man of letters, who wrote many novels, who wrote also theatrical works, and he published this work, which is called The Privilegi dell'Ignoranza, Privileges of Not Knowing. I will not translate it ignorance with the privilege of knowing. And it's essentially a conversation, a dialogue between a Native American woman and a European. And of course, the one who prevails, who wins the debate, is the Native American woman.
What is she saying? Does this take the form of a debate, or is she just simply filling in this Italian as to the complexities of Native American life?
She does fill in the Italian, more the complexity on the beauty of Native American life. What comes out of this is happiness, essentially. They are happy because their desires, their wishes do not extend beyond their possibilities.
That would certainly be a key to happiness, wouldn't it?
Yes. And actually, the quantification of happiness is one of the main debates in 18th century Italy.
Well, of course, the pursuit of happiness, a big phrase familiar to those in the United States in their Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
When you get to about this time. And does the tribal life have anything to do with this? In other words, the fact that you're living in a close but relatively small community where everybody knows everyone else and presumably supports each other rather than in a large city where there's a lot of anonymity and disinterest in other people. Do you see that in these writings?
Yes. I'm going back to Carli, for instance, Gianrinaldo Carli, the author of Lettere Americane, American Letters. He does refer to the anonymity of city life, essentially, but essentially to how unpleasant it is to go to meetings.
To go to meetings?
Well, something's never changed. To go to meetings, and instead of going to meetings, I am so happy to spend time with the ancient Peruvians in my study at night, because those people really knew what humanity was, what being human was.
Instead of building these kind of layers of artificiality on top of human relations.
Yes.
So this period of Enlightenment in Italy, these 30 years from what, about 1770 to 18, 1800 or something like that?
The Enlightenment? I would say it's between 17, the mid-50s and the early 80s. That's when we can start to see the signs of the twilight of the Enlightenment, the waning of the Enlightenment.
That's pretty fast.
It's fast, but it's intense, just like happiness.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a good slogan, too, isn't it? Fast, but intense. Well, what brings about this decline in the Enlightenment?
Starting in the 70s, the dissemination of English poetry, or the so-called Nordic poetry, plays an important role in the changing of the changing attitude towards life, and we see the same happening, for instance, in almost everywhere in Italy. We also have some important works on the pleasure of solitude, for instance,
that's
read in Italy. Yes.
Certainly a thread that you get in German and in English literature by the time you get to 1800 or so. I wandered lonely as a cloud, in the case of the German, it would be this, you know, Einsamkeit, and celebrated as well as denigrated in some ways. Now, this the fact that the Enlightenment in Italy was so short, is that just because they came to it so late, and by the time they came to it, within 30 years, other areas of Enlightenment were already moving on into what might be called a more romantic era in the early 19th century?
Yes, we start to see the signs of a new sensibility already in the early 80s. And then neoclassicism also plays an important role. The cult of ruins, the cult of the past, the cult of the antique, nostalgia.
Which Italy had a good supply of the antique.
Yes, absolutely.
Lots of ruins to go around.
Yes, and then the onset of Romanticism. But again, there is a period which is between, I would say, the Enlightenment and the onset of Romanticism, which I think is a very beautiful era. And that's the time when we can see the development of a new sensibility. Because we cannot talk about happiness, we cannot talk about unhappiness either. It's like a gray area.
Really happy or unhappy? How long can that kind of attitude last?
Yes, it's like in between. I cannot define the meditation or the reflections on solitude like indicative of unhappiness, detachment from passions, detachment from emotions that can lead to a very, very interesting literary movement.
Well, let's get into that in a moment when we return. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Stefania Buccini, and we're looking at the Americas in Italian literature, particularly in the 18th century and into the early 19th century, as we pass now from the Age of Enlightenment, which was only about 30 years in Italy because the Italians came to the Enlightenment fairly late in the game. And that will get us into the 1780s, by which time we're getting into early Romanticism in places like Germany and England. And you mentioned a little while ago, Stefania, this idea of ruins and imagining of classical times, ancient times. And I couldn't help remembering that the English in particular seemed to be fond of actually building things that were already ruined. That's a serious manifestation of nostalgia for an earlier time. Do we see that kind of thing in Italy, too? I mean, were there already ruins? Why would they need to build their own?
Well, I think I found these with cemeteries. And I was actually studying this for a while. I published a book on the sentiment of death. from the 17th through the early 19th century. And that's where you can see a resurgence of ruins.
In cemeteries.
In cemeteries, yes.
What's the logic behind it?
The logic is the connection with the person who's gone through the ruins.
So they're kind of both relics in a way.
Relics, yes. And we find very interesting solutions. Very interesting. Like the tomb itself becomes a so-called means to reconnect spiritually with a person who's no longer around. So...
If we look at the Americas again, what sort of spiritualism, if you want to call it that, would the Italians find when they're looking with some nostalgia, let's say, at America as part of this noble savage concept? Would that be part of that also, that the Native Americans in particular, you mentioned earlier, the Incas, by being so close to nature, have this kind of spiritual connection of that's all their own, that is so much harder to find in Europe?
Yes. And I find, actually, I found this also in relation to the American Revolution.
The Revolution, how does that tie
the in? Perception, the Italian perception was essentially that the American Revolution was a rural movement to defend freedom, the right to freedom, the right to pursue happiness.
It's interesting how that American Revolution influenced events in Europe where there were monarchies and one was being overthrown from afar in America. How did that play out in Italy where you still had monarchs at this time, this admiration for the American Revolution?
American Revolution was an event, probably one of the most significant event of the 18th century, I think. You're talking about a movement against England, against tyranny. And when I use tyranny, I refer to Vittorio Alfieri, one of our major Italian poets. He was the founder of Italian Tragic Theater, who wrote a collection of five odes entitled L'America Libera, Odes to Free America.
What did he say in these odes?
These odes are like, I would say, like sequences, almost like five paintings, I would say, devoted to specific parts, sequences of the revolution. Of course, he supports the revolution because it's a way for humans to affirm the right to freedom and, of course, the right to happiness. They go together, freedom and happiness. Vittorio Alfieri devoted five odes to the American War of Independence, these five odes bear the title of L'America Libera, in English, Odes to Free America. However, I found earlier translation of some of the poems. I did find some early translations in the early 19th century. In the early 20th century. Vittorio Alfieri, to answer your question, he was reading the Gazettes and what was happening in America. So he was very well informed at the point that he sent a copy of the work to General Washington in 1781.
One of the tenets of the American Revolution is the early constitutions, the Articles of Confederation and the actual Constitution of the United States were put together. One of the tenets was the separation of church and state, but Italy had about a 2,000-year tradition almost of integrating church and state, didn't it? by then?
Yes.
And so how did that appeal or not to those in power at that time?
Well, I really haven't found anything specific about this. I know that Alfieri was a secular person, I think he was very happy to see what the colonists were doing, and like him, many others.
What are the other aspects of the American Revolution, or if you even want to call it American culture at this point in general, that Italians picked up on at this time?
American Revolution for Italians represented essentially the reaffirmation of freedom. The freedom could be reached, could be achieved. But also, even for many intellectuals who were involved in the debate on happiness, American revolutions and eventually the outcome of the American Revolution with the Declaration of Independence confirmed that they were right, that all the work they had put into studying happiness, into analyzing happiness, was definitely good. It was helpful. Something that I also would like to bring up is how Italians were involved in the Declaration.
Indeed. How were they?
Yes. There was Filippo Mazzei. Who was a Tuscan gentleman, a physician and a man of letters, who became acquainted with Franklin and other Virginians in London. And they invited him to go to Virginia to introduce the culture of wild grape and olive oil, olive trees. And as soon as Filippo Mazzei arrived in Virginia, he became pretty good friends with Thomas Jefferson.
And Jefferson, who had a very big interest in wine.
Yes, and I'm sure they were enjoying wine while talking about about the turmoil. It's pretty clear, according to President Kennedy, that Filippo Mazzei participated in a way indirectly in the drafting of the Declaration of Independence. He wasn't on the committee, but there is a passage that was translated into English in one of the articles that Filippo Mazzei published on the Virginia Gazette.
And so he's getting these ideas from where that he passes on to Jefferson and his contemporaries?
From the Italian debate on happiness. On happiness and also equality.
Equality.
Yes.
How far is he going with equality? Of course, you know, famously, all men are created equal. Is that the extent of where it goes in Italy, or is there a broader approach that we would consider more contemporary today?
Well, all men are created equally. It's what Mazzei wrote in this article for the Virginia Gazette. He wrote in Italian and Jefferson translated into English, because Jefferson was familiar with Italian. I think in the 18th century was a little bit of an abstraction, because, of course, society itself was a response to inequality. The way Italian society was built, of course, was not really reflecting this noble thought.
There was a strong class structure?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
We'll look further at the Enlightenment and Italian views of America as we get into the 19th century, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Stefanie Bucchini. And she is telling us about the American way of thinking, let's put it, in Italian literature as it turns up in the late 18th century and into the early 19th century, and particularly pivotal in this whole thing, the American Revolution and the ideas that came into and out of the American Revolution. You mentioned a connection, Stefani, with Thomas Jefferson just now, but you also mentioned Franklin. How did Franklin play into this relation with the Italians?
Franklin was, I would say, one of the most appreciated enlightened figure by Italians. There is a beautiful book by Antonio Pace devoted to the myth of Franklin in Italy. Benjamin Franklin received a copy of part of the work of Gaetano Filangieri, a man of law, and this work was devoted to the science of legislation. The title was La Scienza della Legislazione, published between 1780 and 1785. Some of the volumes came after his death. He died pretty young. Filangieri corresponded with Ben Franklin in regard to this work. This work was a comprehensive system for drafting laws based on general principles that would be useful to all countries, all people, and all times. So it was almost like an Enlightenment dream.
And how did Franklin react to that? What was his response?
Franklin reacted very positively, and he wrote him. They had quite a significant correspondence, but there is a letter that reached Filangieri while he was dying, and his wife responded to Franklin. So Filangieri died at 36. So we are talking here about a genius, somebody who wrote this work at 28.
And what are the principles that come out in the theme of this book?
Essentially, that it was a book against feudalism and against the church.
Okay, against now it starts church. To get interesting, because again, we're in Italy.
I guess, yes, and this explains why these volumes were put on the Index of Forbidden Books in 1784.
By the Catholic Church.
By the Catholic Church. And the main focus of this book was happiness. Again.
Happiness achieved how?
Achieved through finding a unique system of legislation that will make everybody happy. And there is a beautiful part I'm translating from Italians. Essentially, according to Filangieri, happiness is the result of the private unhappiness of all individuals that constitute society.
Say that again.
According to him, happiness is the result of the private unhappinesses of all individuals that constitute society. Essentially, he thought that this was wrong. In order to make only a few happy,
It required the unhappiness of the many.
Is the resulting, essentially, of the unhappiness of other people.
And what was he suggesting through these laws that would ameliorate that?
Equality.
Equality. So back to all men are created equal.
Exactly. And
why would the church have a problem with that?
Because the church was a target.
Oh,
with
it was.
With their abuse.
Why was he? What was he pointing out in the church that would make for collective unhappiness or unhappiness of the masses, as opposed to the upper echelons?
Inequality, property.
Okay, sure.
And an important thing, which I think it's also a main focus in the Enlightenment, needs.
Needs.
How can you prevent crime? How you can prevent unhappiness? By reducing the needs of people.
Taking care of those people who might not be all that capable of taking care of themselves.
Yes, yes. Need, it is what leads people to commit crime, for instance. And this is the main topic of Cesare Beccaria, of Crime and Punishment.
Why would the church have an issue with that? Isn't that pretty much a Christian concept, to take care of the poor, those in need?
Yes.
So what's the church's problem with that?
Well, probably he's referring to the feudal structure of the Roman Catholic Church at that time.
That had just been carried over from centuries before.
Yes.
And so this book got banned. What was the effect, though? I mean, didn't people get to read it anyway, or was it strictly just impossible even to print it or publish it?
Well, in the 18th century, the index is not as severe as it was in the 17th century. So you could pretty much read the books that were put on the index. But this was a little bit different 100 years before this time.
What was the, the author died, as you say, at the age of 36. So there wouldn't have been much of an effect on him no matter what. But the church is just saying, what, a good Catholic will not read this book? Or was there more to it than that?
Probably yes. But again, the attitude of the church towards book in the 18th century, especially in the 80s of the 18th century, is not as severe, as drastic as it was in the 1620s, for instance, which I have studied extensively. Between 1620 and 1640, the church was absolutely much, much more severe towards books.
And that severity took what form? What was the result for a person who would write and publish such a book in the 17th century? What was the tradition that was laying the groundwork for what we would see later?
Could I focus on a few dates? Some dates are important. So the Inquisition was founded in 1542. And in 1571, the Inquisition decided to build another mechanism to help with books, with the circulation of books, contra fidem, which means against Catholic faith. And this happened in 1571, when the Congregation of the Index, the Holy Congregation of the Index, was founded in Rome. So the Inquisition essentially could not focus on book anymore, because so much was happening. And this is happening especially at the beginning of the 17th century, when books and printers are incredibly, incredibly powerful.
Because it was relatively easy to disseminate books in great numbers.
Yes.
And I gather also that there was increased literacy too, and I suppose even a larger class of people who could afford to buy these books.
Yes. But it was, for the church, it was a threat for the dissemination of the Reformation, essentially, of Reformed texts. So they wanted really to make sure that they could control the press in order also to preserve Catholic purity, the purity of Catholics. So the 17th century, the early 17th century, is essentially the moment of the strongest reaction of the church against books. Another important date is 1633, the Galileo trial. But we need to think about something very, very important. The Church and the Inquisition are essentially the same body. I mean, not the Church, I'm sorry, the Congregation of the Index and the Inquisition were the same body, but they worked very differently. The Inquisition was essentially working with books that could not be reformed. Galileo, of course, nothing to do. And so the Inquisition worked with fire, let's put it this way, burning books, because they could not be corrected. The Congregation of the Index was working with ink, with corrections.
Oh, so they would they literally alter these books, or would they simply put out a contradictory point of view?
They had different techniques. There were cases, especially in the early cases, when censors rewrote parts of books or literature books.
That's different.
Which is different, without the author knowing. And of course, since they have done so much work, they insisted that their names were put on the book.
These people correcting the books wanted their names put on it, too.
I did most of the work.
Well, it would be easy then to tell which ones have been monkeyed with.
But then there was a more democratic approach, and this is when censors, sometimes local bishops, would meet with the author, sit down, and rewrite together.
Under some pressure that they would apply to the author, I assume?
Yes. The book was first had to be put on the index. Once it was on the index, the author was relaxed and say, okay, now it's in somebody's hands. Then they would contact the author and say, okay, so if you want your book to be published again, we need to rewrite certain parts. Let's talk about it. And I found documents at the Vatican that confirm that censors were working with authors.
That's really interesting because in the 18th century and well into the 19th century, you see that same approach with opera. And operas by Verdi, for example, Umballo and Maschera, set in Italy, it had to be moved to Boston so that the politics would not be so inflammatory of a head of state being assassinated and other things too. And Verdi read into it in other instances too, as did other composers. The censors were very powerful, weren't they?
Very.
And we're talking about largely political censorship.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So this is part of that same phenomenon, although it sounds as if the church was more directly involved in these cases in the 18th century.
Absolutely. The church was very, very involved at this time. But something that we need to clarify, it's important because many times on the television you can see these documentaries on the Inquisition. They're not always correct because the Inquisition was taking care of books that could not be reformed. But the Congregation of the Index had a different approach. First of all, we also must remember that for a 17th century author, it's normal to submit to an authority. It can be God, it can be the prince, it can be the pope, a bishop. It's normal for them.
Yes, it was very common throughout the 18th century.
Yeah, the 17th, yeah, that was pretty normal. And again, there were what I found at the archives of the Inquisition. I found the documents that reflected the trial to the book trial. The minutes of the censors during meetings when books were essentially being examined and put on the index.
Well, it's fascinating that they kept such detailed records of these trials that we learn a lot about the thinking on both sides of the issue.
Yes, these documents have been declassified only in 1998.
By the church,
by the Vatican. And now I think every year there are new ones that are going to be available to scholars.
And what else have you found in the closing minutes of our conversation in these relations between church and Enlightenment thinkers?
At the Vatican? I found incredibly wonderful information. First of all, what really is impressive is that the book is treated like a soul.
Like a sword.
Like a soul. Essentially, the correction of the book was giving the book the possibility to be republished as confession was giving the
these
the
retractions,
person.
Right? Isn't that what they are, retractions?
Yes, the possibility.
Kind of like a denunciation of the author's own work in some cases?
Yes. I have one here. Is the recantation submitted to the index? It was a formula, but of course it could be more personalized. This is about an author, Francesco Pona, who wrote a very provocative novel inspired by the doctrine of transmigration of souls.
Yes, that could be
the church didn't particularly very controversial, and so I this is a the decantation. Fece la mia adolescenza un aborto credendo figliare pomo maturo, e fu la composizione della lucerna. Rimasi ingannato non dall'amor proprio, ma dagli applausi che troppo la commendarono, perché non è carica per molti, ma per i pochi, per i saggi, a provar libri. Terminò questo santissimo tribunale che dall'opera s'avesse per sospesa. Io subito sentii lo stesso e sento tuttora, e per iscarico di mia anima supplico che sia deputato censore alla correzione di detto libro, a ciò che le coscienze che hanno da esso potuto ricevere scandalo, fuor d'ogni mia intenzione, restino edificate, o almeno non offese in trascorrere quelle vanità giovenili, affermando che né per timore né per alto rispetto umano e per altrui immaginabile persuasione mi muovo a questa ingenua espressione, ma solo per la gloria di Dio e per la salute dell'anima mia. Grazie. Dated April 3rd, 1636.
And they're saying in a few words?
In a few words, the author is submitting to the Congregation of Index his request to appoint a censor to review his work, and he regrets the topic he treated in this novel. He completes this petition by saying that he does this essentially for the health of his soul and to please God.
It's a fascinating glimpse into the Enlightenment and Italian attitudes toward America at that time, and also the way things were in Italy, somewhat different from what we would find in America even in 1633. It's been a pleasure, Stefani Puccini.
It has been a pleasure, Norman.
And I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join me next time for University of the Air.